Good evening, everyone. For this is Hanukkah to one and all. Thank you for coming. Those who are live and those who are on Zoom, welcome. I hope you're enjoying a little bit of Hanukkah so far. I want to begin by thanking our sponsors for tonight, Melody and Bob Harris, not just for sponsoring, but they sponsored tonight specifically in honor of the Young Israel Rabbanim. Really appreciated very much your partnership and your support. It means a lot. Thank you so much for sponsoring tonight. And gesture is so much appreciated. Very, very touching, very, very sweet. I also want to thank the Rabbanim for joining me tonight together, biyachad, and hopefully a meaningful night of learning. I always like to say, I said it this morning at the shir, that Hanukkah, for some reason, I'm not sure why historically, was a Yom Tif where the Greeks were goes there, they decreed against Talmud Torah. And somehow, in all schools, whether it's elementary schools and high schools, even yeshivos, what happens during Hanukkah? They cancel all shiurim, and they go on trips, and they have water parks, beautiful. And they have mesibos, very nice. But the truth is, the ikur, the ore of Torah, really is the essence, the ikur of Hanukkah. And so it's such a pleasure to really join together tonight to be able to learn in a meaningful evening together in our Beit HaMedrash. We're going to hear three different approaches to Hanukkah tonight. I want to share, I know I overwhelmed some of you, a couple of you asked about the source sheets. I understand a lot of sources here. We're not going to cover all of them tonight. I want to really address, in the few minutes we have together, a very integral issue of what it means in terms of a bias. If you ask anybody in terms of how to define Ner Hanukkah, and specifically the obligation to light Ner Hanukkah, everyone knows the well-known phrase of the Gemara in Shabbos, Daf Chaf Aleph Amud Beis, where Chazal tell us, Tanu Rabbanan, Mitzvah Chanukah Ner Ishu Beis. The Mitzvah of Chanukah is a mitzvah on the Ishu is the homeowner or the household, and everyone who's under their umbrella in that household, Ner Ishu Beis. What's unique is, and there's so much Torah that's written on this and ink spilled on this, that the idea of Ner Ishu Beis is not clearly defined. In other words, if I asked anybody here to define what it means that a bias, not a person, if I tell you you're obligated in the mitzvah, me the gavra, the person, it's easy to understand. But what it means that a bias is obligated in Ner Hanukkah, that's much more amorphous, much harder to define. And in fact, we'll raise two questions initially to help you understand how difficult of a question or a concept this is. For example, we'll see in a moment. Let's say, lo aleinu, somebody is homeless. I don't mean homeless, chas v'shalom, in the way that they're literally living in the street, but rather, for whatever reason, they sold their house, living in a hotel, and going from place to place. They're staying by an uncle, staying by a cousin, they're going to their parents for a little while. They really have no home base. So would you say that the person now is pater Ner Hanukkah? Are they now exempt from Ner Hanukkah? That's question number one, right? Because Ner Ishu Beis, so if you have no bias, maybe there's no chiyuv. That's number one. And number two, another manifestation of this idea. Let's say you're a guest, which is, again, one of the most major topics in halacha. In fact, I'll bet you, if I look at my list, I write down all the shailos that I get over the course of the many years, the last 18 years in the Rabbanus, every Yom Tif, and I ask Rabbi Simon certain questions we discuss, I write them all down. So be forewarned. If you ask me a shaila, it's written down somewhere in a book. And I look back every year at the questions that were asked, and almost always, every year, Hanukkah, the number one question that's asked is, fill in the blank. I'm going somewhere for Shabbos, to my parents, to my in-laws, to my cousin, to my brother. And should I light there? In fact, my twin brother Adam, who's really a tremendous Talmid Chacham and one of the most fine and good-looking human beings that I've met in my entire life. Even the Zoomer, thank you, Joni, for laughing. He actually texted me a fascinating paper, Shmuel Kamenetsky, in his sefer. He has a collection of halachos. So he had a chiddush or maybe a novel idea, which other posts can bring also. Let's say somebody, for example, leaves their house after the Zman Chiyuv. Now, what's the Zman Chiyuv in terms of lighting candles? What would you say? When's the obligation, the time of obligation? Is it Seif? Or maybe Shkia, maybe sunset? So he says, since you can technically light from Plag HaMincha on, that's the Chiyuv. So once Plag HaMincha comes, the obligation set in, and you can't leave your house to go somewhere else. So my brother said to me, he said, I'm supposed to come for Shabbos. I have a problem. We're never ready on time. And we're not going to leave our house after Plav Mincha. What should I do? I said to him the most important words that I thought I could think of in the moment. What did I say to him? We don't paskin that way. Baruch Hashem, we don't paskin that way. But if we did, imagine, again, you have no bias. You're relying on the Baal HaBayis. So what do? Most common question asked every single year on Hanukkah. So let's begin by talking about question number one. Again, defining what a bias means in terms of, let's say you have no home. You have no set place to live. What do? And so there's a great sefer called Time of the Kra. Rechaim Kanievsky, it's a beautiful sefer. It's actually very deep, very philosophical, very halakhic. It's on the back page of the packet if you want to look for a moment. But he says that this issue in terms of not having a bias is a machlokas rishonim in between Tosfos and the Rambam. What's the source? So look at Tosfos on the page. Haro aner Chanukah tzorach levarich. B'shar mitzvot kegon alula v'sukkah lo takinu levarich leroa. Other mitzvot, you never have the concept, the idea that somebody who's a roa, who sees a mitzvah, do you see a lulav, you make a bracha? No, the mitzvah is to shake. You see a sukkah, you don't make a bracha. Only ner Chanukah, elagabe ner Chanukah. Mishum chavivus hanis. Because of how dear the mitzvah is to a person. Look what he writes now. The gam mishum sheish kama b'nei adam shein lahem abatim ve'in b'yadam l'kaim ha-mitzvah. And also, he adds, there are people who have no house and can't do the mitzvah, and therefore to give them at least an opportunity for what? For some semblance of a mitzvah, we gave them a chance to at least make a bracha as a roeh, but not as a madlik. What would Tosfos say about a person who's quote-unquote homeless in terms of lighting Ner Chanukah? What would he say? What? You say somebody else, and would he light? No. Is he obligated at all? No. It seems like not. It seems like not. In other words, he's saying that since there are people who aren't obligated, i.e. they have no home, therefore, to give them a chance, they can make a bracha as a roeh, seeing the candles, seeing the lights. But in terms of their obligation as a homeowner, there's no obligation. So says Tosfos. But Rechaim Kanievsky points out that the Rambam seems to argue. And the Rambam, in Hilchos Brachos, Perek Yud Aleph, I know we're on very borrowed time here, so I'm going to try to go through the sources more expeditiously. Let's skip to paragraph 2 for a moment. He's talking about what level of obligation a person has to try to chase after mitzvos. In other words, let's say they're difficult to attain, difficult to achieve. How much do I have to go out of my way to achieve certain mitzvos? So he says, so to mitzvos that are, what's divrei sofrim, which is a complicated verse or a phrase in the Rambam in general, but let's assume for now they're rabbinic in nature. Whether it's a mitzvah that's a chova midivrayan, obligatory, like mikra megillah, hadlokas ner b'shabbos. Megillah is from where? The rabbis. It's not from the Torah. Ner Shabbos is from the Nevi'im. It's not from the Torah. Vadlokas ner Chanukah. And so too, lighting of ner Chanukah. Or mitzvot she'inan chova that aren't obligatory, like eruv. If you don't need an eruv, you don't have to build an eruv. Instead of sedayim, you don't have to eat bread, you don't wash. What's unique about this Rambam in terms of his categories that he made here, the categorizations he made here? What do you notice? He made two different lists of rabbinic mitzvot. And what did he say? There are some like Megillah, Ner Shabbos, and Ner Chanukah that he seems to say are a chiyuv, as opposed to those which are Einan Chova, which are not a chiyuv. So Rav Chaim Kanievsky says he believes that the Rambam would clearly argue on Tosfos, where Tosfos said that those who have no home are not obligated in Ner Chanukah. They only have the obligation and perspective of the roeh. The Rambam says that each person seems like Megillah, like when it comes to Ner Shabbos, The obligation is actually on the person's life, and actually somebody who wouldn't have a bias would be, he claims, based on this Rambam, obligated to light. So again, you see the first manifestation of this idea that, you know, the bias is a little bit amorphous. It's hard to really figure out. If the Gemara says near Yishu Beisel, you would think that if there is no bias, there is no obligation. And yet we see, he claims, that there are those, we show him, who would say, like, even though you don't have a home, and the Gemara quantifies it as you are only obligated if it's near Yishu Beisel, nevertheless, there are those who obligate you in the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah. Okay, that's the first section for tonight. The more important section for tonight is actually relevant to something that's coming up this Shabbos. I mentioned before about people who visit their families over the course of Chanukah, especially when it comes to Shabbos. And the Gemara has a famous idea, or actually a little bit of a famous story, on Chaf Gimel Amun Aleph, where the Gemara tells us the following. Amar Sheshes, Ach Sinai, Chayev b'ner chanukah. What's Ach Sinai? I guess it's obligated in Ner Chanukah. Now, if we stop right there, what's the Gemara trying to tell us? A guest. Where's the guest? Somebody else's house. What did we say before in the Gemara? Ner Ish? Uveso. So what does that mean? How can you have both? If Ner Ish Uveso means that I am the homeowner, it's my bayit, it's my house, that means that if it's not my house, I would assume that I'm not chayav. I may want to join with the Baal HaBayis afterward, but I'm not chayav. Yeah, that's...
Can we define Beisel as household?
So what's the household?
So here's the guest, that part of the household. So instead of defining Beisel as the house, it's his Beisel, his household, as opposed to his house.
Well, what's the difference? In other words, if I'm a guest, household, I assume, meant those who live in the house or supported by the house.
He could not fulfill the mitzvah through the owner of the house. He would be obligated to do the mitzvah himself as not being part of the household.
Very good. Excellent. Dr. Ekman says very well. In other words, what the Gemara might be saying is that the Baal HaBayis is chayav because he is, it's his bayis. It's Ner Ish Uveso. The Ach Sinai is chayav because, fill in the last part of the sentence. Because?
Because he's not part of the household.
But it's not his bayis.
It's not his bayis, and it's not part of, right, it's
a guest. So is he recreating his bayis in a new location? In other words, Mimonashach, either way, if he's part of, he's now living or sleeping in the, or eating in the home of this fellow. So he's covered under Ner Ish Uveso. And if he's not, maybe like we saw earlier from the Palitosis, he shouldn't be obligated.
That presumes that he's in someone else's house. If he's in a hotel where there is no...
Right. So you could learn the Gemara that way. You could say the Gemara is talking only in a case where the Ach Sinai is in his own location. Thank God for the new concept called Airbnb, right? So who would have dreamed years ago that you can actually rent your own house and be a Baal HaBayis where it's not really your bias? Right? It's hard to believe, right? We can have that concept all the time nowadays. Certainly hotel as well. Although hotels, I always tell people, the most important thing near Chanukah is safety, right? My Rabbi always... Those who know Rabbi Simon very well, so every year when they have the question and answer session for Ner Chanukah, people always ask, where should you light? You know, in the front window, in the back. And he said, the mitzvah to light is the safest place in the house. Wherever it's safe, that's where you light. That's A, right? So when somebody asks about a hotel, most hotels, the sign clearly says on the door, what does it say? You are never to light a fire anywhere in this room. And so I'm not judging anyone, but there are people, obviously, who do and just don't tell. But I don't know. It's not. That's a difficult thing. Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik Zatzal was oft said to some of his Talmidim that he believed that a battery operated menorah, not plug-in, because plug-in, you know, all the oil isn't there; it's coming from the wall, right? But a battery operated menorah could not just be a bidyeved, a substitute for a menorah, could even be Roy Lebracha, fit for a bracha, right? Because all the, I use the word oil, but it's, loosely. All the energy is there at the time where you put in. So it's a bulb, all there when you put in. And that could be possibly what people could do in those situations where they can't light a, people on a plane. Now, I don't think anybody's going to light a fire on a plane. At least I hope not. What? In a hospital? Where you can't write? Well, they give out. You know, near Shabbos, they always give out the electric ones, right? It's always a part of the Bikur Cholim room always has the near Shabbos that's electric. Okay. So, it's interesting. So, the Sfas Emes, the Gera Rebbe here has, I'll call it a Chakira, brisker Chakira, on this Gemara. The Gemara continues and says, Amr Bizera, Meiresh ki havina be rav mishtafina bepriti. Pahad yushpiza. When I used to go to Rav, I used to give him money and join him in the mitzvah of Ner Chanukah. Buster din Nesivi, but after I got married, Nesivi Issa, Amina. Hashtavade lo tzuchina, de kamadlik alai, the gold besai. But now I don't need to, because now they're lighting for me at home, my wife's lighting at home, when I'm already visiting somebody else. Which is, by the way, what did he notice about the Gemara? Where he traveled by himself. He wasn't going with his whole mishpacha. Away for Shabbos Chanukah or for a night of Chanukah, whatever it was. But that's the end of the Gemara. So Rav Zeira says that he would give a coin initially to the Baal HaBayis, but he stopped doing so when he got married because he had now a bayis, which was back where he left at home. So it says Sfas Emes, the underlined part. The Yesh La'ayin, Iha mitzvah ner achas habayis, kamo mezuzah, u kamo ner Shabbos. Dichol shehidlik l'shem Shabbos, Ashehidlik Mishayiya Dai. No? So the Sfas Emes says, near Shabbos and Mezuzah, nobody would say, if you sleep by somebody for an entire year, are you obligated to Mezuzah? No. Why? Chovas Hador. It's the obligation for those who are the homeowner. Okay? You sleep in a hotel for 3 months straight. You should never do that, by the way. Bad idea. But if somebody got to be, I had a very close friend of mine who unfortunately had a terrible fire in their house. They were from Jamaica State, and the insurance company put them up in a hotel, they said, for 2 weeks. 2 weeks. A year and a half later, they were living in a hotel. There's two chidushim there. The hotel and that the insurance paid for it. That's also a chidush. It's a wild idea. They lived hotel for literally for a year and a half. It's a wild... wild story. So right to the Sfas Emes, the Gera Rebbe says, Mezuzah and Ner Shabbos, you light one for the entire house. Everyone who's there is subsumed in the mitzvah. Ulefizeh, Esher, Degam Beis Bali Batim Hadarim Bebayis Echad, Dai Lohem B'Ner Echad. So therefore, if two people share a dwelling place, the Sfas Emes says, maybe they only need one menorah. Very good. So he asked me a kasha, he says. Oh, the Gemara says, v'hadu ushpiza mishtatev v'priti. The fact that we just saw in the Gemara that the ushpiza, the guest, can what? Give money and join in the mitzvah. Yishlomar shehu kidei lasos ha-mitzvah b'mamono. That's an additional idea. That's not just about lighting, but rather it's about me doing the mitzvah with my finances. I should be involved, dedicated to the mitzvah financially. Avam midina yotze, but technically, if we live in the same dwelling, which happens sometimes, you have sometimes children, you know, in Europe certainly it happened a lot more, multifamily dwellings, right? The parents live there, the grandparents live there, they're obligated in how many? Maybe one menorah. They share a home, near Yishu Beisel. They're all considered part of that home. Or, O, Neba da mitzvah al kol adam, ela da ba'al habayis motzi kol b'nei Beisel. Or maybe the analysis should be the mitzvah really dahu on everyone. It's just that the Gemara says that the Baal HaBayis can cover everyone else who's under the umbrella of what's called his bayis. Now, is there a nafka mina? Is there any difference between these two parts of the Sfas Emes? A very good analysis, right? Two people live in the same house. Maybe it's one chiyuv because it's one ner yishu beisel. They're one bayis. Maybe, he says, it's each of their obligations. It's just that one Baal HaBayis can cover the entire household as like an umbrella situation. That's what he says. So I'll show you one nafka mina, a fascinating nafka mina, actually halacha l'maisa, not just for academics, but even for halacha l'maisa, which I'm not sure most people necessarily either know or practice. But nevertheless, good to share. People who come for Shabbos, let's say this Shabbos, the coming as a guest to somebody, people have their children, have their parents over, or siblings, whatever it is. Okay? So if you ask for a salavetrik, what would he tell you? Not only is it not a choice, the Gemara says, the chayiv of the achsanai, you have to give, only option is to give the balabayis a pruta, or money, mishtatish in their mitzvah. It's not your choice to like. You certainly can't make a bracha, the Rav would say. You wouldn't be able to do that. But what about the oil? About the oil. Okay? The Pri Chadash writes something which I think we all take for granted. This is how we usually assume this should go. Ach Sinai, she madlikin alav b'vesto, tzarech l'aseiz pruta l'bal habayis. Okay, so we saw the Shulchan Aruch said you give a fruit to the Baal HaBayis, money to the Baal HaBayis, to include yourself in his mitzvah of lighting. Or yitne lo Baal HaBayis chelek b'shemen u'psilos, or the Baal HaBayis gives the guest part of the finances of the wicks of the oil. U'mikan nira shemishdatev in chaveiro ein tzarech lahosif b'ner mashenasan lo o mitzas. What about the Baal HaBayis? What does he have to do to include me as the guest in his mitzvah? Says the Pri Chadash, you know what he has to do? Nothing. I don't speak Yiddish, I always say it, but the word is garnished. Correct, Bob? That's the word? Garnished. Right? Garnished. He does nothing. And that's what we all do. We all assume that the guest comes. You know, when I was in Memphis, Tennessee for Shabbos, visiting a shul in Memphis, Tennessee, so my host, Mr. Philip Baum, beautiful human being, wonderful people. He and his wife, fantastic. He said to me, Rabbi, I have a beautiful menorah for you. I put it down for you. I set it up for you. It was like the fifth night of Hanukkah that year. And I said, I really appreciate that. I'd rather give you money to be included in your light, in your mitzvah. He said, I'm not taking money from you. I said, no. I said, Mr. Baum, you don't understand. You can give it to tzedakah if you want. I need to give you something to be included in the mitzvah. And we had a whole vikuach, is Erev Shabbos 10 minutes before shul started, right? So, a little bit of last minute, I guess I never thought of what would happen in those cases. So in the end of the day, what did I do? I heard his lighting, we were all good to go, wonderful guy, very deep southern drawl. Never heard that before, a real Memphis, beautiful accent that he had, Mr. Brown. But this pre-chadash is what we take for granted, that all of us just come, you give the Baal HaBayis some money, and we're good to go. Writes the Bach, not so fast. Kasa Baguda, Shemati Mishashitev im Chaver Lener Chanaka, Tzark Lahustiv Mashiyitain Lo Chavero, Akan. The time Odim Lo Nikr Shahusti Bishvil Chavero, Iker Chashta Lo Marshal Nishtapis. So the Bach says, hold on 1 second. You can't just give the Baal HaBayis a pruta, and he's including you in the mitzvah. You can't do that. Why? Because where is the hakara? Where is the recognition that you joined the mitzvah? Elamai, he has to be mostly, he has to add a little bit of shemen to signify that you are also included in his mitzvah. And that's what the Pri Chadash says. A little bit of shemen to represent that he's now adding to his mitzvah by including you. Okay. Furthermore, one of the great students of the Magen Avraham, Eliyahu Rabbah, writes something which I think almost nobody does. He goes through these different opinions here, and he talks about people not giving any additional oil, maybe a little oil, and he writes the following. Lachain nearly taima, shamadlik mechuyiv litin kishir chatzisha mi mamono. Lekach tzarech lahosis, kulo, dim lokain, lo nasanhu kidei chiyuvo. Wow. Writes the Eliyahu Rabbah, he says, when you're a guest in somebody's house, well, I mean, there's two parts to this. Number one, you have to give maybe enough kesef. You know, sometimes, what's a pruta? What's a pruta? Nowadays, you know, under the chuppah, the rabbi asks the chassan a few important questions. What's question number one? Are you related to any of the edim? Are they related to you, to Chassan and Kala? Hopefully the answer is no. I actually did a chuppah once where the answer was yes. Even though the sheet that I give out says, under all the kibudim, it says, no relatives for any of the Edim sections. But it's always awkward because then you have to call up somebody else. So Baruch Hashem, we were able to leave the cousin who was called up for a bracha. So the fourth bracha guy got the eighth kedushin, and the eighth kedushin got the fourth bracha. It worked out. Shalom on Yisrael. Worked out beautifully. Wonderful solution for that that problem. But the second question he asked was, is the ring worth a shava fruta? And I would imagine it is. Platinum, silver, gold, whatever it is, I would hope that it is. But, I know mine was certainly painful enough to worth a shava fruta. Certainly worth a shava fruta. So the Eliyahu Rabbah writes, he has to give enough that it covers the oil that's being put in, and the Baal HaBayis has to put in enough oil, not just to show a hakara, but rather for the sheer halakha. In other words, to burn for half an hour after dark. Wow. Nobody does that, right? No one does that. Okay? In fact, I'll show you an amazing tshuva. I'm not going to see the whole tshuva tonight because it's not enough time, but the Betzal HaChachma, or Betzal Stern. We ever see a Rav? Ever see a Rav? There's certain Rabbanim that are known because of the location. Rav Sternbach, where was he originally a Rav? South Africa. So he has fascinating questions because the clientele there was very irreligious, and he was asked some very unusual questions. Rav Bezalel Stern was a Rav in Melbourne, Australia. So he also got some very fascinating questions from down under. Got that right? Down under. So he wonders, and you can read it on your own, he wonders, you know, let's say you're the Baal HaBayis is such a firmak. What's a firmak? A makbid, right? A firmak. So he's makbid every night. You know, in the olden days, before they had the gel things or the already made ones, I remember I used to do this. You used to take the oil and pour it into the cup. Okay? So you'd pour enough, let's say fill it up halfway, it lasts an hour, hour and a half. Let's say the Baal HaBayis every night is makbid to fill up the entire thing. Why heder mitzvah? I want it to burn for 4 or 5 hours. So what shaila do you have now? You can't add. So ask the Betzal HaChachma, what do you do in that case? Now you have a guest at your house. According to at least two opinions, you have to add some oil. There's nowhere to add. What's the simple answer? Either don't fill it up all the way, or just the kavana, when you have intent. When you fill it up all the way, you say, you know what, I filled it up halfway, and the second half now is for my guests. That's already enough, the kavana, to cover. Even those who are machmir, who ask you to add oil, will allow that if you have the right kavana. That's the idea that he says to answer those questions. Yeah, Bob.
Can't you avoid all of these scenarios? Like in your case in Memphis, I don't know if you were there with the Rebbetzin or not.
Of course, and Yehuda Galler.
Okay. If you're traveling on your own and your wife is home in Ishko Kagufo, you don't have to worry about Shifra's
wife. And that's what the Gemara said, right.
So you don't have to light at all. You can just watch and look at his menorah.
100%.
Okay.
All right, but if I go away by myself, what other problems do you have? Shalom bayis. Right, so if somebody goes away on business, for example, that happens often, and there are people who can't light, whatever, they're traveling overnight, whatever it is, so you have that idea, the Gemara says.
Yeah.
Somebody lights at home, 100%. 100%. Yeah, 100%. Right. But I thought to myself, it's fascinating, these opinions in terms of adding oil, not adding oil, what would you say in terms of how they're viewing the idea of a bias? If you wanted to be a real, you know, lamdan and give a chakira, what would you say? The Pri Chadash, who says you have to add no oil for the guest. Why? Because as the Baal HaBayis, you can expand your bias. You can include the achsanai. Those who say you have to add oil, what would they say? The bias always remains the same. My bias can't include someone who came for just a Shabbos or for one night. It doesn't work that way. They live somewhere else. And therefore, I have to somehow make or create a situation where they have their own bias, i.e. by having oil in the cup for themselves. But without that, not part of my mitzvah, not part of my bias. It's a very interesting, very delicate chakira in terms of how you view what you should do. Most people, I would imagine, myself included, probably don't do this. They just give a pruta and they just are, you would say, that way. But I wanted to conclude, I want to make sure I end on time. We're actually on time right now. Just a little drush, a thought. One of the classic Hasidic works, the Maor Vashemesh, has a beautiful idea on this concept of Neri Shabbos that I thought really brought together all the things we discussed tonight in terms of what it means to have a bias. If you have no bias, are you a chayev, are you patur? Or if you are a guest and you have no bias because you're traveling, can you be included in somebody else's bias? Can they expand their bias? It's a beautiful idea. Near B'derech Remez, he writes, Ki ha-tzadikim ha-zokhim le-nefesh ha-kedusha ve-zokhim el-haruach azayucha le-sakin cho-am-mukhubarim imo ha-nikroim beiso. He says, a tzadik, a righteous person, who is elevated in kedusha, can somehow figure out a way to include all people who he's connected to in their bias. Kimo beis Aharon. What's beis Aharon? Who does that include? Well, all Kohanim slash Levim, right? Do they all live in Aaron's house? No. So why are they called Beis Aaron? Because he was the central hub to whom they connected. He brought them all b'yachad. He brought them together because of who he was. And maybe, just to end al-Derech Drush, you can read the rest of the piece together. He has a beautiful remez as well in terms of the words. The idea that maybe Chanukah is a time to remind ourselves of how to redefine our bias. You know, the concept that we sometimes forget the great achrayus and privilege that we have to have guests, not just guests in terms of friends, but expand your, you know, our definition of what it means to have a bias, to have guests who need a place, people who are either in need, people who are in need of friendship. Maybe the message of Chanukah is that a bias shouldn't be limited to just the four walls of who lives there, but rather include those who even come from the outside, expand our bias to include them, make them feel like part of our hand, part of our bias as well. That's the idea I want to end with. Look, we'll stop here for now because Rabbi Finkelstein is about to start. Thank you all. Yeah, Arthur.
Just, why would you take that concept and expand it in other ways? Like when you make kiddush, when you yotzei for make a kiddush for a guest, you don't pour extra wine into a cup. You're not asking for prutah or anything like that. What is the limitation?
Right. So I guess it's only because Chanukah has this unique idea of bias, which doesn't exist anywhere else. But I would say it's interesting you raise that point because an excellent ha'ara, there are those, not about Neri Shubeis, though, there are those in terms of Kiddush who not only do they not add wine, they won't allow somebody else as a guest to make their own Kiddush. Why?
Barabah
Hadis Melech. Because we want to have the greater kavod is to do it more in groups, the bigger group. And so I remember my own Rebbe, Rabbi Simon, we discussed this issue. I grew up in my house. I don't know if your house also. So I made my own kiddush growing up. My father wanted a chinuch. He paid thousands of dollars in tuition. Should get his money's worth. And they could make our own kiddush. So when I got older, I lived through this again. And I said to Rabbi Simon, I said, you know, it seems like one person should make for everyone. So he's like, yeah. So I said, what do you do when somebody comes to your house and they make their own kiddush? So Rabbi Simon said, I don't ask. I just make Kiddush, right? That's the right? Interesting idea. But you're right. It's only by Chanukah you have this idea that you're adding, because whereas other mitzvot, it's of course you can be part of their mitzvah because there's a shittuf in terms of achrayus, in terms of being yotzi somebody else. By Chanukah, because the Gemara gave the specific rubric or framework of bias, it's unique to Chanukah only. Excellent hara. Okay. I'm a time person, so no. Pesach, only me. Thank God. Although if we have guests, their own Baal Bayis, I give them their own matzah. You can ask people in the community to come for my Pesach Seder, so they get their own matzah, their own Dal Kosos, and I always ask them if they want to. So but I always follow up by saying, I make a beautiful Kiddush. If you want to hear mine. I always want to say that. That's the end. Yeah. Okay, all right. Finkelstein, without further ado.
Number of years ago, I had a Rebbe.
challenge them with the question of whether we really want the Beit HaMikdash. He used to ask us that we say all the time that we want the Beit HaMikdash to come again. And we say we want Mashiach now. But this Rebbe, he used to challenge us with the question of whether we really need it.
If we really understand what it will mean to have a Beit HaMikdash, do we understand that that means that all the Kohanim will need to adjust their work schedules around the service in the Beit HaMikdash? Any Kohanim in the room? One, two, four. Do we realize that having a Beit HaMikdash means that every single time we unintentionally violate Shabbos, we'll need to spend hundreds of dollars on an animal to bring as a carbon chatas? And do we all really deeply appreciate the notion of animal sacrifice? That we're so thirsty for that most fundamental of Beit HaMikdash practices to return? And this question used to challenge us to think. And my friends and I, we would reflect upon these shiurim, and we would wonder, what would we truly answer to that question? Did we really, deeply, feel a loss in our lives because we didn't have a Beit HaMikdash? But what I want to suggest to you tonight is that there is a very real reason that every single one of us deeply and passionately wishes that we had a Beit HaMikdash. Because there's something lacking in all of our lives which we very rarely give formulation to. And having a Beit HaMikdash would solve that problem. And even if we don't fully understand every deep value the Beit HaMikdash stands for, and even if one day we are going to need to work hard in order to understand and appreciate the Karban Chatos, there is a central aspect of the Beit HaMikdash which all of us do understand. And as we'll explain, it's also the core message of the Yontif of Chanukah. Our religious lives, as they exist today, lack a certain measure of clarity. We all fiercely believe in Hashem, but we need to work very hard in order to notice His presence. Sometimes, we even ask ourselves questions to the effect of, does Hashem really listen to my tefillos? Is Hashem really involved in the events of my life? And the answer to all these questions is a resounding and an emphatic yes, but it takes us time to process and to understand what that means. The Ramban already notes this phenomenon, and he tells us that in certain times in history, Hashem's presence is harder to see and to feel than in others. And while it's certainly there, we need to make a conscious effort in order to notice it. But the thing is that our religion is not supposed to work that way. There are supposed to be elements to our religion which provide us with such a sense of clarity and affirmation of Hashem's presence and of the fact that He's taking care of us that we don't even need to think twice about it. There are two aspects of our religion which are supposed to serve that purpose. The first is nevuah, prophecy. The Ramban tells us that historically there have been people who have questioned and even denied the truth that Hashem speaks to and interacts with human beings. But then the notion of prophecy comes and flat out proves that wrong. Because a prophet converses with God, and he experiences firsthand that Hashem does interact with people. There was once a time that a person could walk around the streets of Yerushalayim and hear a Navi telling over prophecy that he had received from Hashem. There was once a time that a person could have a question. And he could go to a Navi and ask that question, and the Navi would give him the answer from Hashem. There was no confusion, and there was no ambiguity about Hashem's relationship with us. Hashem was easily accessible, and he was there for us to call upon him. The second thing we're missing is Nisim, miracles. To be more precise, we're missing Nisim Guluyim, supernatural miracles. There are miracles which happen in the course of nature, which we do witness. We witness the birth of a healthy baby, and inexplicable phenomena in nature, and we see hidden miracles. And to move from the everyday to the more extraordinary, we witness the birth of a Jewish state. And we see a six-day war victory. And we come very close to seeing supernatural miracles. I'll share with you a quote. It's a remarkable quote that a general of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point once shared when he was asked the question of why at West Point they don't teach six-day war strategy. And he responded, "At West Point, we are concerned with military strategy and tactics, not miracles." We see these types of miracles, but we fall short of seeing Hashem openly, unequivocally, and supernaturally declare his presence to mankind. And the Ramban identifies Nisim as the second aspect of religious life which removes confusion. He explains that at one point in time, people questioned whether Hashem truly runs the world, and Hashem, in response, then performed the miracles of Yetzias Mitzrayim, which proved in incontrovertible fashion that Hashem does run the world, and that he's very much present in all of our lives. The Beis HaMikdash, with all of the other critical things that happened in the Beis HaMikdash, was a place of supernatural miracles. And because of that, it was a place of utmost religious clarity. A person who would walk into the Beis HaMikdash on any given day would observe something called the Ner Ma'aravi. What was the Ner Ma'aravi? The Ner Ma'aravi was the westernmost, according to some Rishonim, there's a debate about which candle exactly it was, but let's call it the westernmost candle of the menorah. And the Ner Ma'aravi would burn much longer than it should have burned. It was the first candle that the Kohen would light every day, and it would burn well beyond after all of the other candles had gone out. And this would happen day in and day out, every single day, miraculously, and seemingly inexplicably. The Ner Ma'aravi would defy every single law of nature, and it would remain lit way beyond the amount of time that it should have been. And Chazal tell us that the purpose of this miracle was to be an edus l'chol ba'ei olam sheshchina shora b'Yisrael. It showed everyone that Hashem's shchina, Hashem's presence, resided among the Jewish people. And there were no questions about it. There were no ifs, no buts. It was unequivocal and apparent to a person who would see this that Hashem was there. A person who would walk into the Beit HaMikdash on a Shabbos afternoon would see the newly arranged Lechem HaPanim on the Shulchan. And this bread, the 12 loaves of bread, would be fresh. They would have just come out of the oven. And that same person would then come back on the next day. And he would find that, remarkably, the bread was just as fresh as it had been on day one. And it didn't make any sense. Because there were no preservatives added. There were no Ziploc bags, and there were no freezers in the Beit HaMikdash. And yet the bread would still be just as fresh as it was when it had come out of the oven the day before. And that person, not only that day, but he'd come back a week later. He'd come back the next Shabbos, on the day when the Lechem HaPanim would be changed, and they would put the new bread on the Shulchan. And remarkably, the Lechem HaPanim would still be fresh. It was a miracle. It was a supernatural miracle with absolutely no other explanation. And when Klal Yisrael had to make political decisions in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, when they had to make decisions which related to even things such as national security, whether to go to war, whether to not go to war, they would consult the Urim V'Tumim. The Kohen Gadol would present the question to Hashem, and Hashem would respond by lighting up letters on the Choshen, the breastplate, which would spell out the answer. Now, the Choshen wasn't made by Apple or Windows. The Choshen didn't have any computer chip inside of it, which was causing the letters to light up. It wasn't following any type of algorithm. It was a flat-out miracle that Hashem performed in order that we should know the answer to our question. And so when I think about my Rebbe's question of why I want the Beis HaMikdash, I often find myself thinking about that measure of clarity. How different would Jewish life look if any time we wanted to see Hashem's presence, we could simply go to the Beis HaMikdash and see it? How different would our emunah be and our commitment be if we saw Hashem openly and inexplicably defying nature at his will? I think when we talk about what we're missing by not having a Beis HaMikdash, this lack of clarity in our lives is a big part of it. But what's interesting is that this sense of clarity only existed in the first Beis HaMikdash. The second Beis HaMikdash was an entirely different type of experience. The Gemara teaches us that there were five things that were lacking in the second Beis HaMikdash, and one of them was the Urim V'Tumim. During that time period, the direct connection to Hashem was a little bit obstructed, because no longer did the Kohen Gadol receive clear instructions by having the breastplate light up. And the Gemara also tells us that after the death of Shimon HaTzadik, which was relatively early on in the second Beis HaMikdash period, certain miracles no longer happened with consistency. Among them were the fact that the Ner Ma'aravi no longer always burned beyond the amount of time that it should have. Sometimes it would burn in miraculous fashion, and in those times Hashem's presence was apparent. But then there would be days and weeks and months when the Ner Ma'aravi would burn out just like every other candle. Sometimes there would be a miracle, and sometimes there wouldn't be a miracle. And furthermore, the Lechem HaPanim, the bread, no longer stayed fresh every week. Sometimes it did, and a Kohen who'd be on shift that week in the Beis HaMikdash saw an incredible miracle. But sometimes it didn't. These miracles were no longer guaranteed in the second Beis HaMikdash. The second Beis HaMikdash did not have miracles in this consistent and open fashion that the first Beis HaMikdash did. And not only that, but there was no nevuah in the times of the second Beis HaMikdash. The last of the Nevi'im, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, gave us the instructions as to how to build the second Beis HaMikdash, and then after that, prophecy ceased to exist. Why was this the case? Why was the second Beis HaMikdash of such a lower stature than the first Beis HaMikdash? So Chazal explained to us that the reason is because we didn't properly embrace the second Beis HaMikdash. When it came time to build it, Ezra, who was the leader of the people at that time, implored all of the Jews of the exile to come back and rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, and only a fraction of the people listened. The rest of them stayed behind in their comfortable homes in Galus, and their routine Galus lives. And as a result, Hashem punished us. And he didn't give us the same type of clarity in the second Beis HaMikdash, to which we were privy in the first Beis HaMikdash. And this reality tormented and anguished the tzaddikim of that generation. Haggai HaNavi tells us that when the second Beis HaMikdash was rebuilt, the old tzaddikim who were old enough to have remembered what the first Beis HaMikdash had been like were in tears. Because they looked at this structure and all they could think of was how it paled in comparison to the first Beis HaMikdash. They saw the younger Jews getting all excited about the second Beis HaMikdash. We have a Beis HaMikdash back. We have Yerushalayim again. And these people, these older tzaddikim, they shook their heads in grief, wishing that they could just explain to that generation what they were missing, what the first Beis HaMikdash had been like. And the Navi describes how these tzaddikim believed that the second Beis HaMikdash could never be as great as the first Beis HaMikdash. Never again could they achieve the level of clarity that they had had at that time. Never again would Hashem's presence be open and clearly apparent. But then Chagai delivered a remarkable nevuah. Chagai told the people that actually, in due time, there would be clarity. Hashem would show how there would be clarity even in the second Beis HaMikdash. Hashem would show the people that among all the mystery, there would be a time that Hashem would openly show the Jewish people that His presence was apparent even in the second Beis HaMikdash. Chagai said, "V'hirashti es kol hagoyim, uva'u chemdas kol hagoyim, umileisi es habayis hazeh kavod, amar Hashem Tzvachos." Hashem says that He will startle all of the nations of the world with a magnificent event which would fill the second Beis HaMikdash with glory. What was that event? Yeah, so Rashi says, "Benisim hana'asim levnei chashmonai." Chagai's nevuah refers to the miracle of Hanukkah. The Hanukkah miracle would show the people that Hashem was still there in the second Beis HaMikdash. It would make it clear and apparent that even though the miracles were inconsistent, and even though the clarity wasn't on the same level, Hashem's presence resided in that Beis HaMikdash as well. And if we could just think for a moment what that must have been like for these people. If we could put ourselves in their minds for a moment, the people of the second Beis HaMikdash, they grew up hearing legends of the first Beis HaMikdash. They have been told, they have received stories of a building where one could go on any given day and see Hashem's presence open and revealed. And these people easily believed it because they also sometimes saw miracles. Miracles did happen in the second Beis HaMikdash, just not consistently. The Ner Ma'aravi and the Lach HaMapanim, as we explained, they sometimes showed their miraculous qualities, but not always. It wasn't guaranteed. In the minds of these people who lived in the times of the second Beis HaMikdash, clarity and real Giloy Shechina was an old story. It belonged to a different generation. The ability to encounter Hashem in such a real way just belonged to a time of old, the olden days, in which they just didn't live in a time like that. Lahavdil, when I was thinking about this idea, the mushel that came to my mind is that it's like the way that sometimes we think about religion in Europe or in the shtetl. We sometimes hear unusual stories about gedolim and tzaddikim, and these people just come from a different world and a different time and place. And we're sometimes, when we hear these stories, we're left breathless and speechless as to how there could have been a time that people were so righteous and so learned. And we hear about these glory days and a time that doesn't exist, and we think to ourselves, that's just not our reality. That's out of a storybook. That's from a long time ago, but that's not the time that we live in. And that was the way that the people in the second Beis HaMikdash thought about the first Beis HaMikdash. They thought that just belonged to a different era. That type of clarity was from an older generation that just didn't exist in their time. But then Hanukkah happened. And the nace of the Pach Shemen rocked the world of the second Beis HaMikdash. When one small jug of oil defied all laws of nature by burning for 8 days, all of a sudden, Hashem's presence was revealed and open, and it was encountered. There was a clarity of experience the likes of which these people had never seen before, and for them it was like a story right out of a storybook. And they wondered themselves, could it really be? Could a miracle of this proportion really be happening in our Beit HaMikdash? And the answer was yes. Because Hashem was announcing to the Jewish people that he was still there. Even then, he was still present and was very much a part of their lives. The Gemara tells us that the Nes of Chanukah was the last of all the Nisim. Since Chanukah, there has never been a time that a supernatural miracle has been performed for Klal Yisrael. Yes, certainly there are still hidden miracles, as we mentioned earlier. But a miracle in which Hashem defies all of nature to announce his presence has not happened since Chanukah. And so Chazal told us that we must preserve the Nes of Chanukah. We can never forget about what we experienced at that time. Because at that time, Hashem showed us that clarity can still exist. He showed us that he is still among us and it is possible for us to experience him in an open and revealed way. Even if we sometimes think that it cannot, the reality of Bayis Rishon can once again exist. When we light Hanukkah candles, we're reminding ourselves that we can get that reality back. When we light Hanukkah candles, we're telling ourselves that just like the Jews in the times of the second Beit HaMikdash, Hashem gave Klal Yisrael a glimpse into the clarity of Bayis Rishon, and we also can one day return to that reality. And when we light Hanukkah candles, we're realizing that our current existence is not our end goal. There will one day be apparent and clear Kivod Shamayim in the world. And we will have that open encounter with Hashem's presence that gives us that sense of clarity. The Rambam tells us, and with this we'll close, that Ner Chanukah mitzvah kaviva hi ad me'od. The Chanukah candles are a very precious mitzvah. There's no other mitzvah for which the Rambam uses a formulation like this. Because Chanukah candles tell us the story of a people that are yearning and longing for clarity. And it reminds us that such a time can exist again. May we be zochah to see it, b'mheirah b'yameinu.
I'll take a minute or two to perhaps stand up, take a donut, arm wrestle, whatever.
Are you waiting for that? Is the chat full of that? Oh, wow. I actually did not look at my phone. It's good. It's good. That was the message to take it down. Okay. We figured it out. We solved Hanukkah. Funny five screen. Harry, why is it still here? We don't need to see ourselves, do we? Hello, everybody.
go closer to the computer and remove the source sheet. I guess every dollar source sheet is still on the screen.
I took the source sheet down.
No, it was probably on the screen.
Yeah, I took it down.
Oh, okay.
And I'm going to just move closer to the mic, know what people said? How about this? This is as close as we can get without getting in the way of each other. All right. Okay. You can stop the arm wrestling, Will. This past Sunday night, my family were driving home from Woodmere. We had a Hanukkah party there. And around 7:30, we were driving down Hempstead Avenue. We heard a lot of fire trucks. It's on Hanukkah, it could be a little scary, God forbid, unfortunately these stories happen. But there were like these bedazzled fire trucks that were driving down together. Lights, sirens, all the blaring, all the exciting stuff, and it turns out we're just new to West Hempstead. There's some kind of fire truck parade that was going on. What'd you say? Okay. My kids are really excited. I thought, wow, they're so excited by my emergency vehicle, but really, no, on top of the fire truck was Elmo. Elmo was there wearing a firefighter uniform. One of my four-year-old daughters in the back asked me, Abba, is that the real Elmo? And without thinking, I was tired, I said, no, it's a person in a costume. And my wife gave me this look, like, you just stole her innocence. Like, what have you done? But she recovered very quickly in the back of the van. She said, oh, that makes sense. The real Elmo is the one in Sesame Place. That's the one that we saw. Yeah, that's the real Elmo. This is just the West Hempstead Elmo. This was a person in a costume. And it occurred to me that for little kids who don't know enough about the world, it's hard to understand what's real and what's supernatural, what's fake. The truth is, just in the last week, my kids have asked me about the following items, if they're real or fake. Astronauts, superheroes, unicorns, and asparagus. Speaking about our diet at home. But they don't know. They see it on TV, and they see it on watching Sesame Street. And they wonder, are astronauts real? Going to space, is that real? Probably for a period in time. That seems supernatural. Who can imagine going to space? Who can imagine eating an asparagus? Right? From what they know, from their perspective, a zebra is pretty exotic. A unicorn is also really exotic, so it's different, many colors. So it has a horn. A bison has horns. I mean, how do we know what's exciting, what's real, and what's not? For little kids who don't really know enough about the world, it's hard to know what's real and what's a miracle. And if you think about it, from our own limited perspectives on the world, do we really know what's real and what's innate? When we see something operating in a way that's different than how we're used to, we get really excited. That's innate. That's a miracle. From Hashem's perspective, is it really different? Is it harder for Hashem to split the water or keep it together? To have things grow like this or grow downward? To have gravity pull things down or have things floating in the air? Well, maybe gravity here is one way, and maybe gravity in space is something else. It's a different law of physics. The question is, what makes something real? What makes something supernatural? What makes something exciting? It's just a question of our inability to explain it.
or our unfamiliarity with having seen it. Rav Dessler describes miracles in this way. In place of our shir this week, in volume 1 on page 177, he has a beautiful essay where he talks about Nes and Teva, where he explains that people just typically define a miracle as being different than Teva, and that Teva has laws, Teva has rules, and Nisim, they bend the laws of nature. They go beyond the laws of nature. The reality is the laws of nature are just as much of a miracle to us, except for the fact that we're used to them, that we're bored by them, that we see it every day, yawn, day in, day out. You know, science is so excited all the time. They think they can explain everything. They get so excited when they figure something out. But science never really explains the why. They're just able to see more what's as the microscopes get better, as they're able to split an atom, as they're able to go further into space, so they can see more what's. But they're never really explaining why. So vitamin C is good for you. Okay, why? Well, because it has these enzymes and proteins. Okay, why? Why is that good for you? Well, the body has this lock and key system where it's opened up by these enzymes. Okay, but why does the body need those enzymes? Well, the body has these proteins and this and this. And okay, but why does the body need those things? At some point, even the greatest scientists say, well, that's just the way it is. That's just what it is. Given these rubrics, given these building blocks for how the world works, this makes sense. If something operates on a different system or doesn't follow these laws, then it's innate. Then it's supernatural. Then it's amazing. And it's wild. I heard on a science podcast recently, they were marveling at the miracle of birth. And they just like took a second and they stopped and they said, you ever think about how crazy it is? It's just like life and conception can be created to create a complex organism? And they're like, yeah. And they moved on. But we would have gone further and said, what does that mean? Like, that is a miracle and it is wonderful and it is the laws of nature, but it's wild. Who decided that's going to be the way it is? But because we're so used to it, if we're used to it, it's almost in Sesame Place and that's where he belongs. He's in West Hempstead, all of a sudden, this is different. What's going on? Can you explain this to me? The reality is, Elmo here, Elmo there, it's probably the same Elmo, probably the same sweaty guy, right? But there's no real miracle one place more than another. He's not really more unusual in one place more than another. He's just unfamiliar in one place more than another. In that sense, we're all like little kids. The things that we know and recognize, we see as natural. And the things that are different, we have questions, we want to know, how does that work? And sometimes we get answers. But sometimes not, and we're left marveling at what could perhaps be a miracle. You know, Chazal talk about miracles in Pirkei Avos. In the fifth parak, they list 10 miracles, 10 things that were embedded into nature at the very end, Bein HaShemashos, of the 6 days of creation. The Keshes, and the ground for Korach, the Be'er, a lot of different ideas. And the Rambam, in his commentary there in Pirkei Avos, has an amazing comment, where he writes that these 10 things aren't only these 10 things. While they were singled out, he explains details not for now. He said, what the Mishnah is really telling us is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu placed into nature, at the very fine print at the end of all of creation, Hashem said, but there's going to be times in which water operates differently. Water's property naturally is to stay together, except for the times when during Kriyas Yamsuf, when Yoshua crosses the Yarden with the people, and a couple other times where the water is going to split. But the water splitting during that time is not really supernatural, the Rambam says. It's what was put into nature to make sense naturally at those times. Water usually goes like this, and that's natural. And sometimes water goes like this, and that's natural too. Every miracle in history had to be put into the natural days of creation. Because when a miracle happens, it's really the natural way that Hashem chose to make it operate differently for those times. Nothing new is happening. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not re-intervening to change the laws of nature. Because the laws of nature contain the possibility of miracles as well. And by our Dessler's terminology, it's not that miracles means going beyond the laws of nature. It's a different set of laws of nature. HaKadosh Baruch Hu isn't less or more involved in one than he is in the other. And the Rambam writes that really this teaches us that even the most miraculous things are just nature, just a different nature. What you think about is the exact opposite of what the Ramban says at the end of Parshas Bo. In a list of top one Rambans that are famous, most famous, this is number one at least. Also referenced a few minutes ago. So two references in the same night. I think I'm right about that. This Ramban at the end of Parshas Bo talks about that the miracles that Yetzias Mitzrayim were meant to teach us, not only about the supernatural things, but that all of nature is also a miracle. So look at that. Diametrically opposed views. The Rambam of Pirkei Avos said that even when miracles happen, it's a different version of nature. And the Rambam is saying that no, even when we have nature, it's really just a nes nistar. It's a average everyday miracle. But they're not really diametrically opposed. In fact, they're saying the exact same thing. So many years since I took 7th grade math. Any teachers here? Commutative property? That sounds familiar? A plus B equals B plus A? You can just reverse it. It's the same thing. Teachers? No objection. Also no rent. But that's the idea. If miracles equal nature, then nature equals miracles. It's the same property. It's the same principle. Because what really is the difference? It's just different ways of looking at the same thing, one we're familiar with, and one that we're not. And even the things that we're most excited about. Kriyas Yamsuf comes to mind. The greatest miracle, the quintessential paradigmatic example of a great miracle. Rambam told us it was put into nature to happen at a certain time in a different natural way. I always thought it was amazing. When Moshe Rabbeinu goes to put the Yamsuf back together, after it stayed open for so long, Hashem says, stretch your arm and the stick over the water and bring it back. That's the same thing he did to split the water. Shouldn't it just be, when the miracle is over, it falls back to its natural state? Uh-uh. He has to do the exact same thing to split it and to put it back. It's the same thing. To go from one to the other is to go from the other to one. Because it's not more Hashem's hand in one over the other. One is more unusual because it doesn't follow what we're used to. But if water always splits, if we saw it together, we'd say, that's interesting. That's the hand of Hashem. Tchiyas HaMeisim, another one of these big miracles way out there, can't imagine possibly happening. But that's what talks about it in this essay. He says, can you imagine if you look at your back window and you see a person who was buried in your back lawn? We're not going to ask why that happened, how it got there, but okay, your backyard, a body buried over there. And all of a sudden you see like a finger poke through, and another finger, and then a hand, and it starts to like push itself, it's like a horror movie, right? Pushes itself out, and it pushes himself out of the ground, and he says like, I'm finally free. You probably do a lot of scary things, right? You probably want to figure out how the person was murdered and who buried them in your backyard. But also, miraculously, Tchiyas HaMeisim can't possibly happen. Dessler said, every time plants grow, the exact same thing is happening. You have a seed that came from something that was alive, that rots, decays, decomposes, and then starts to grow new life out of it. A new tree pops out of the ground. And all of a sudden, this gigantic tree produces fruit, and it's alive. And we say, boring. That's an asparagus. It's not so exciting. You don't get so excited. Why not? Boring. Is Tchiyas HaMeisim so wildly unimaginable? For HaKadosh Baruch Hu to take living things, have them decompose, and come back to life? Well, we've seen it so many times. But if it's in a different way, a different version of the same nature, we get excited. We call that a miracle. Elmo really isn't any less weird in West Hempstead. He is. But he's not really any more different in West Hempstead than he is in Sesame Place or Sesame Street. It's just the abnormality and the unfamiliarity with it that gets us to ask the question. We're a little closer to the computer. Okay. Let me get a microphone for the computer. And when it comes to Hanukkah as well, we asked about the principles and asked about the properties of oil. We have to ask the question of what's natural and what feels like a miracle. The Gemara Maseches Tainis in Daf Tafei has a whole parak about miracles. Rabbi Chanina Mendoza in particular was involved with so many supernatural events. And the Gemara tells the story where one time he came home Friday night and his daughter was miserable. And he asked her, why are you so sad? Now, if it was my kid, it's because her sister stole something that she didn't really listen to. Okay, whatever. But I know why the kids are sad on a Friday night. But he wasn't sure, why is this kid sad on a Friday night? And she says, you know, I lit Shabbos candles before. I accidentally mixed up the container of oil and the container of vinegar. I accidentally lit Shabbos candles with vinegar. And it's not going to work, and I'm so miserable. I ruined Shabbos. And Rechari Mendoza has an amazing line where he says to her, Misha Amr L'Shemen V'Yidlok, the same God who told oil, your property is to burn, he also can tell vinegar to burn in the same way. And you know what happened, the Gemara says? Those candles lasted all the way until Motzei Shabbos, which they used for Havdalah. Amazing idea. Many different takeaways from that story. One of which is, it's not really more natural for oil to burn than vinegar to burn. We're just used to one. So for the other one to do something beyond this normal, familiar version of Teva feels supernatural to us. But Rabbi Chanina Mendoza's point was, it's not really different. It's the same God. It's the same one who created nature. My kids want to know every single night, why is my oil menorah still burning after their candles go out? I'm always tempted to say, it's the miracle of Hanukkah happening again. I get so excited about that. But the answer really is, whether I tell them this or not, this is based on how I'm feeling each night. But the answer is, oil burns longer than wax. But who says? Does it have to be that way? Oh, the properties of oil are like this, and the properties of wax are like this, and the amount of wax in those cheap, colorful candles is like this. Okay, but why? Why is that the property of wax? Why is it the property of oil? Why do any of these things exist? At some point, even science has to say, that's just the way it is. I don't know, that's the way it is. Every year it seems there's more and more answers to the famous question. We can't possibly go one evening without asking the question. That's attributed to the Beis Yosef, though those before him asked it as well, of why is Hanukkah 8 nights? How could it be? If they had enough oil to last for one night, the miracle was only 7 additional nights, why is Hanukkah 8 nights? Answers abound, thousands and thousands and thousands of answers to explain why is there an 8th night of Hanukkah. Bali Mitzer, the author of Kelm, of Yeruchim Levavitz, many others, they say, the question doesn't make any sense. What are you saying? That for 7 nights it's supernatural, but for the first night it's natural? That's worth celebrating too. The fact that one jar of oil burns for the amount of time of one jar of oil is also worth celebrating. Why is one more miraculous than the other? Because we're not used to it? Isn't Hashem, according to the Ramban at the end of Parshas Bo, isn't Hashem just using the supernatural to draw our attention to the natural? They're all His creations. Rav Finkelstein pointed out so beautifully the negative aspect of not having open miracles. It's incumbent upon us, whenever possible, to look at an Nes Chanukah, to look at a miracle that was open, and to say, how does that not only prove Hashem is still there, but how does it uncover that which is with us every single day? That's where we put Al Anisim, in the Modin. Rav Meir Chadash, who was Mashkiach in the Chevron Yeshiva, he pointed out if a person forgets to say Al Anisim in davening, what do? You don't do anything. You don't repeat. But he asked, what would happen if a person forgot modim? All of it. He forgets all of modim. Would the Yotish go to Esrei? Probably not. He didn't daven modim. If you forget to mention the supernatural, your Yotish, we put it in there, it's important to say, to recognize, to bring our awareness. But only because it's trying to teach us about the Nisecha, Shebechol Yom Imanu. If you skip that paragraph, that bracha, then you're not Yotish, because that's the ikkar, that's the main point. It's the teva of every single day. It's where the oil naturally burns. That's worth celebrating too. Bali Musar point out, that's what we say in Malos Sur. B'nedina, Yemei Shmona, Kavu Shir Ranana. Very wise people established 8 days for singing and praising Hashem. What makes them so wise? Miracle lasted for 8 days. 8 day holiday. Brilliant people. Brilliant, brilliant people. Who could have thought? 8 day miracle, 8 day holiday. So it was brilliant. You know why? Because everyone asked with 8,000 answers, why is Hanukkah 8 nights? I would have made 7 nights, because the first time was natural. B'nai Bina, smart, intelligent people understand, Yemei Shmona Kavu, we have to establish an 8-day holiday. Because they understood with great insight. The Bina allows them to realize that it's not just a reflection on the 7 extraordinary nights. Because the 7 extraordinary nights aren't really more extraordinary than the first night, when oil burns, or vinegar burns, or oil burns longer than wax. Or we have zebras versus unicorns. Or fictitious things versus asparagus. Right? None of this more supernatural than anything else. It's what we're used to and what stands out to us. This is the idea we're trying to bring to our awareness at this time of year. To fully appreciate, to fully understand the significance of. It's not just the one-time miracles, the things that stand out to us. Those are meant to draw our attention. To get us to look, like the bedazzled fire trucks or the Elmo inexplicably dancing on top of the fire truck. Those are to get our attention, to get us to stop and marvel and to say, something different's happening here. What can I notice? How do I realize that really science, chukim, everything is just built into nature? And it's really a question of what are we used to, as opposed to what is actually supernatural? So Dessler explains, and we'll end with this, Hanes v'hateva, really two sides of the same coin, as the Rambam said, in different angles. The purpose of Chanukah, the purpose of any time you celebrate a day of Nisan, the day of Niflos, is really to get us to stop walking through life bored of the asparagus, bored of the growth, bored of the regular astronauts that we see all the time, and to stop and say something special is happening here. Occasionally we need that miracle to shock us out, something that's different form of nature. But it speaks no less to Hashem's ability to govern our everyday lives. And as we're now about the halfway point of Hanukkah, having lit half the candles, it's an opportunity for us to stop and ask not just what can I celebrate for these 8 days, it's what can I take during these 8 days to allow me to feel the Kadosh Baruch Hu's presence, that awareness of his involvement in every single aspect of my life, my family's life, of where he is, how he saved us. These little Shachar Pratis stories, the little things that happen to us, whether it's on Hanukkah or beyond Hanukkah, every time we have those wake-up moments, it's a reminder for us to look around and say, where can I see a Kadosh Baruch Hu? So may we use this time, the rest of Hanukkah and beyond, to recognize that everything is a nes, everything is teva, everything is from Hashem. It's a wonderful opportunity for us to stop and ask ourselves, where can we see more of Hashem in our daily lives? V'yamim ahim, bazman hazeh.